Invite Jolene Sullivan to come forward to light our chalice. And as she does, I invite all of you to join in the words of chalice lighting printed in your order of service. Blessed is the fire that burns deep in the soul. It's the flame of the human spirit, touched into being by the mystery of life. It is the fire of reason, the fire of compassion, the fire of community, the fire of faith. It is the fire of love burning deep in the human heart, the divine glow in every life. We come together this morning again with words to center us, words this time from the prophet Micah, who to the question, what is required of us, replies, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. I invite you now to be attentive to some thoughts from Susan Avery.
A few years ago, Greg Jones stood here to tell us why he devotes his energy to FPC, and he said basically, I don't think he's here, so I can paraphrase him freely, that FPC had been an enormous comfort to him and support to him when during a difficult time in his life, and he wanted to make sure it was around for others who might need such support. And that sentiment rang so true for me. FPC has been a strong pillar for me for 15 years, and has become more and more so as the years have gone by. I know this is true for others, and I want to make sure that it is here for those who follow me as well. It has provided a spiritual home for me with its wonderful music program, through Sunday worship, and other offerings, such as the anti-racism, white privilege workshops that I participated in. I remember the Thursday after 9/11, and we were meeting in choir over here, and I looked up, and I saw the flag in the window that's up there in the balcony, and I have to tell you that I was really upset. I came of age during the Vietnam War era, and the U.S. flag had come to be a negative symbol for many of us, and I questioned the presence of that flag here in church. And as a result of that, we were having Sunday morning discussions at that time, and we had a discussion that coming Sunday about the flag. And there were people there who had a very different perspective from myself, let me just say, who revered the flag, and similar age as myself, but came through the Vietnam War era differently for me. And it was so powerful to be able to hear these people, know they are part of my community, I respected them, and it gave me a very different perspective on the flag. Given its use during, right after 9/11, I was very glad for that. It has also provided a very nurturing place for my children to grow, to learn more about the world around them, how they fit into the world, and to develop relationships with a village of adults, which you all are. And they've learned to stretch their wings through mission trips, through the youth programming, and through various family activities. I'm thinking particularly of the Ferry Beach retreats and the canoe trips. It has also provided me with a caring community that has helped me through the various trials and tribulations of life that life has thrown to me over these years. Although you are not all my close friends, I know that you all care about me as a member of this community. I remember one person who was then new to the choir, and she offered her shoulder to lean on when I was going through a particularly tough time. Although we did not become close, her words of support have stayed with me all these years. I see the same feeling in so many of the faces around me. That proverbial village raising our children and caring for and being cared for by one another. I want to see that spirit flourish for generations to come. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Beautiful words.
Good morning. I'm going to read a piece from the introduction to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Jarvis Cotton cannot vote. Like his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, he has been denied the right to participate in our electoral democracy. Cotton's family tree tells the story of several generations of black men who were born in the United States, but who were denied the most basic freedom that democracy promises. The freedom to vote for those who will make the rules and laws that governs one life. Cotton's great-great-grandfather could not vote as a slave. His great-grandfather was beaten to death by the Ku Klux Klan for attempting to vote. His grandfather was prevented from voting by Klan intimidation. His father was barred from voting by poll taxes and literacy tests. Today, Jarvis Cotton cannot vote because he, like many black men in the United States, has been labeled a felon and is currently on parole. Cotton's story illustrates in many respects the old adage, the more things change, the more they remain the same. In each generation, new tactics have been used for achieving the same goals, goals shared by the founding fathers, denying African Americans citizenship was deemed essential to the formation of the original Union. Hundreds of years later, America is still not an egalitarian democracy. The arguments and rationalizations that have been trotted out in support of racial exclusion and discrimination in its various forms have changed and evolved, but the outcome has remained largely the same. An extraordinary percentage of black men in the United States are legally barred from voting today, just as they have been throughout most of American history. They are also subject to legalized discrimination in employment, housing, education, public benefits, and jury service, just as their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents once were. What has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than with the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals, and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, denial of educational opportunity, denial of food stamps and other public benefits, and exclusion from jury service are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it.
Michelle Alexander continues later in her book with this passage. The impact of the drug war has been astounding. In less than 30 years, the U.S. penal population exploded from around 300,000 to more than 2 million, with drug convictions accounting for the majority of the increase. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rate of nearly every developed country, even surpassing those in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. In Germany, 93 people are in prison for every 100,000 adults and children. In the United States, the rate is roughly 8 times that, or 750 per 100,000. The racial dimension of mass incarceration is its most striking feature. No other country in the world imprisons so many of its racial or ethnic minorities. The United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. In Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, it is estimated that 3 out of every 4 young black men and nearly all those in the poorest neighborhoods can expect to serve time in prison. Similar rates of incarceration can be found in black communities across America. These stark racial disparities cannot be explained by rates of drug crime. Studies show that people of all color use and sell illegal drugs at remarkably similar rates. If there are significant differences in the survey to be found, they frequently suggest that whites, particularly white youth, are more likely to engage in drug crime than people of color. That is not what one would guess, however, when we enter our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, black men have been admitted to prison on drug charges at rates 20 to 50 times greater than those of white men. In major cities racked by the drug war, as many as 80% of young African men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These young men are part of a growing undercast, permanently locked up and locked out of mainstream society. The beautiful, almost haunting music you just heard asks a very difficult question. Senzenina, translated, what have we done? The song comes to us from South Africa, and it was the question that that country had to ask of itself as it faced the reality of apartheid. It was a question about the consequences of racial inequality. It is a question we too have had to ask in our society in the past, in the time of slavery, in the time of Jim Crow, and sadly, now again, in an era which author Michelle Alexander labels the new Jim Crow. Right now in our country, there is a perception that with the election of a black president, we have moved well beyond the racial caste system often referred to as Jim Crow that characterized this country prior to the Civil Rights Movement. We hear people speak of us now as a colorblind society. At the very least, most of us think that even though there are still pockets of racism and unfair treatment, our laws and the way our government institutions operate are colorblind. We want to believe this, but the facts don't support that conclusion. Truth be told, today we have a racial caste system in this country, and one of our institutions, our criminal justice system, is in large part responsible. This is an institution that I know very well. I was a prosecutor, an assistant district attorney, who sent many people to jail. And later, I was a criminal defense lawyer who did my best to keep many of them out. In the nearly 20 years that I worked in that system, I saw some changes. First, I saw the system grow dramatically in size. I believe that I was the 14th assistant district attorney for Worcester County when I was hired. Within a couple of years, I supervised the staff of assistant district attorneys in just one division of that office, which had twice that many attorneys. More things became crimes for which you could go to jail. Judges got less and less discretion in sentencing, as mandatory sentencing laws, particularly in relation to drug offenses, were enacted. Aggressive police investigative work became the norm. I used to supervise or oversee a criminal investigative unit of the state police. I have been there. There was money for aggressive drug enforcement, and that was what we did. We didn't do it in the nice neighborhoods in town, where surely people used, bought, and sold drugs. We did it in the housing projects. And yes, we caught lots of people. And with new mandatory sentencing laws, many of them went to jail. They were overwhelmingly Latino or black. And when we arrested the white guy who came to buy from them or sell to them, the white guy ended up being treated differently in the system. It was never that we intended to be racist. But the way the system was set up led to very racist outcomes. The white guy had more money. He hired a better lawyer. He was more presentable to almost all white juries that were being drawn from overwhelmingly white jury pools. His charges might be reduced to those that carried no mandatory jail sentence. And he had character references and people who were known in the community who would come to vouch for him. They would write letters to the judge or come in and testify that he was getting treatment or had a job waiting for him, which would influence the judge not to impose a jail sentence. Yes, some white folks went to jail, but it was far more likely you would go to jail if your name was Rivera or Sanchez or if you were black. Now, I want to emphasize that for the most part, I don't believe that DAs like myself or judges or police officers were acting in an intentionally racist way. The results were the product of a system that arrested more blacks and Hispanics and was ruled by sentencing guidelines and later mandatory sentences that required judges to incarcerate them, and often for long periods of time. My friends, this was not in the Deep South. It was right here in our state of liberal Massachusetts. And I know things were much worse in other parts of the country. Yes, there is still blatant racism in the criminal justice system. It still infects some police officers and even some police departments. Look at the recent problems in New York City with the stop and frisk procedures. As one of my former colleagues used to say, it is as if being black in the nighttime is a crime in itself. Again this week, a jury failed to convict a white man who shot and killed an unarmed black teenage boy. There is still fear and racism in many white hearts, and just being a young black man in some communities puts your life at risk. We have seen that sad story too many times. I can't imagine what it would be like to be the parent of a black male teenager today. There is direct racism that enters into the system, yes. But the greatest harm comes from the way the system itself operates. And moreover, it's not just what happens in the courtroom, but the after effects of having been incarcerated that make us more and more a society with a permanent racial caste system. The consequences of mass incarceration to black and Latino families and whole communities cannot be overstated. And the cost is great to all of us who live in an increasingly unequal society, brought about by the way our laws are written and enforced, and the consequences of serving time that continue long after a person has served his time and been released from jail, often for the rest of his life. You heard the figures in the reading earlier. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, higher than Russia, China, or even Iran, 8 times that of Germany. Step back a minute and think about that. There has to be something terribly wrong. Yes, there are white men and there are women in jail, but men of color make up the overwhelming numbers in our jail population. In our nation's capital, you heard 3 out of 4 black men will serve time in jail. That's 75%. And they, many of them, will serve long, long sentences. Many of the judges, and I've known that, I've been in the courtrooms with this, who have to impose these decade-long mandatory sentences for what are nonviolent drug offenses, put right in the record that if they had discretion, they would not sentence the individual to that amount of time. And the jail time is only the beginning of the problem. When that black or Hispanic man comes out of jail, having served his punishment, he is punished again and again and again. Ask you, does it make sense that if what we're trying to do in jail or in prison is to return people to being good citizens, that, at least in many states, we deny them the right to vote for the rest of their life? Does it make sense that we deny them entrance into programs or other help that they'll need to establish a life away from crime? Does it make sense not to provide education or job training in jail? Does it make sense to harshly discriminate against them when they're out searching for a job and even prohibit them from even getting a driver's license, making them unable to get jobs and to support their family? In black and Latino communities, instead of helping ex-offenders succeed, the system is making it more and more difficult to stay away from crime after you get out of jail. Today here in Massachusetts, our jails are full. In fact, they are beyond capacity. Right now, here in liberal Massachusetts, There is legislation pending to spend $2 billion to build more prisons to relieve overcrowding. That's not what we should be doing with $2 billion. That's not how we should relieve the overcrowding. I am no Pollyanna. I have seen people who have done some pretty awful things. I have prosecuted them, and I have defended them. And I will be the first to say that there are people who need to go to jail for the protection of our society and for justice to be done. But there are many people in our jails right now that don't need to be there. There are many problems, like drug abuse and drug-related crimes, for which incarceration really does nothing to address the core issues. Perhaps you heard just recently how the governor of Vermont dedicated his whole State of the State address to one problem in his state, heroin abuse. And we've just seen a famous, respected actor and director die of a drug overdose. There's a problem, yes, but prisons are not where we're going to fix it. You know, not long ago, as late as the 1970s, before this, what we've come to term war on drugs, had really sort of wrapped up, but as late as the 1970s, leading and respected criminologists were predicting that the prison system would fade away. In 1973, a very respected body, the National Advisory Council on Criminal Justice Standards and Goals, recommended that no new institution should be built and institutions for juveniles should be closed. How's that compare, to those of you watching the news, to what's going on with juveniles in New York right now, with 27% of them in solitary confinement? They based this recommendation on their findings that the prison, the reformatory, and the jail, quote, achieved only a shocking record of failure. Quote, there is overwhelming evidence that these institutions create crime rather than prevent it. But then came this idea and lots of federal money to fight the war on drugs. And over the years, the laws got more and more harsh and took away more and more discretion from judges. This system that led to mass incarceration is now devastating communities and diminishing the very principle of equality in our society. The war on drugs has become a war on Black and Latino men and their families and their communities. And after spending untold amounts of money, have we made even a dent in the drug problem? I don't think so. It seems to me we've just filled the courthouses up with cases, the jails with Black and Latino men, and the pocket of organized crime drug syndicates with money. The answer to the overcrowding is not to build more jails. It's to take a new approach to the whole arena of criminal justice. We must find an approach that stops the craziness of mass incarceration and all that money that that costs, and does not create a racial class system. Surely it has to begin by reexamining how we classify some of the problems in our society. Not every problem should be labeled a crime and dealt with in the criminal justice system. For the most part, the drug problem is a public health, not a criminal problem. It's also time to get rid of crazy laws that impose ridiculously long sentences for crimes, and time to return discretion to judges. It's time to use programs of pretrial diversion and restorative justice for young, low-risk, nonviolent offenders. And with respect to the people already in prison, it's time to provide them with job training and education and decent health care so that when they serve their time, they have what they need to make it and not return to crime. And it's time to really think about how we treat those who come out of jail. It's time to remove the obstacles that our law imposes that keeps ex-offenders from becoming good citizens and supporting themselves and their families. This problem is all of ours. It's our problem because we belong to a faith tradition that emphasizes as its first principle the inherent worth and dignity of every person. A tradition where we commit to justice, equality, and compassion. This month, we've looked at the teachings of love and the teachings of care for the poor and the downtrodden. The great prophets from the past have taught. We've heard the words of Jesus and Paul and Micah and Amos and the modern prophets of our own faith tradition, which were so wonderfully played in our little skit last week by some of our youth. They have taught us, all of them, from ancient to modern times, that we are called again and again in easy situations and in difficult situations, when the crowd agrees with us and when they do not, to stand on the side of love. And this is yet another place where we need to stand up to be heard and be counted. Our voice matters. If you take this faith seriously, you are called to do something in relation to the devastation that mass incarceration is causing. What can you do? Well, you can start by educating yourself. Read this book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander. It's a wonderfully, thoroughly researched book. And better yet, read it with a group so you can discuss and process it together. You can sign up at coffee hour today if you would be interested in reading that book as part of a group here at church. You can also sign your name on a petition that will be at the social justice table at coffee hour if you choose. It's titled Jobs, Not Jail. Think of what could be accomplished in creating jobs, providing job training, building schools and treatment centers instead of jails for $2 billion. There are many bills filed and pending in our legislature right now that address various different aspects of this problem. You can pick up a list of them downstairs and let your state reps know that you support them. And finally, consider joining some of us at a rally on Boston Common on April 26th, where those petitions will be presented to members of the legislature. The information about all of what I pointed out is on this green sheet in your order of service. Please take it with you. What have we done? What we have done as a society, developing this system of mass incarceration, was surely the product of fear and racism and a lack of understanding of the beauty of difference and the deeper issues that are behind our social problems. We need to let go of fear and commit ourselves to changing the system. Little steps, big steps, they are all important. It's how the promise of this faith finds fulfillment. And a future consistent with the gospels of love, compassion, and equality can begin. May we have the courage and the wisdom and the commitment to do so.